defending our digital civil rights.
We need to stop thinking of ourselves as passive users of this technology, and we need to start thinking of ourselves as citizens of the Internet. And if we want the Internet to continue to be a place that we can use to speak truth to power, to advocate for our own rights, we need to fight to make sure that we have sufficient privacy.
That's Rebecca McKinnon. We replay our 2012 interview with her about her book, Consent of the Networked. Then we look back again at WikiLeaks and what it means for press freedom. We air our 2010 interviews with the late Alexandra Coburn and with Tim Carr of the organization Free Press. And finally, we hear a spring poem from Philip Schultz. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first talked with Rebecca McKinnon in April of 2012, not long after the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. Then the bill died in the Senate, largely because of privacy concerns. But it's back. It passed the 2013 House and is now moving again to the Senate. If passed, the bill would shield big companies that turn over private information to the government. And with the Justice Department overstepping its bounds by going after the email contacts and cell phone records of reporters, not to mention its relentless pursuit of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, and the prosecution of whistleblowers, our digital rights, privacy, and press freedom are coming under threat all at the same time. If passed, CISPA would trump all other federal privacy laws, allowing private internet companies to hand over confidential customer records and communications to the National Security Agency, the military, and other U.S. agencies. It's not the first, nor in all likelihood the last, assault on the privacy and freedom of internet users by governments and private companies. The internet can be a tool for freedom and democratic expression. But the forces fighting to enclose the digital commons are mobilizing. Companies and governments want to control its use for profit and power, and they're using digital technology to corrode civil liberties and human rights. Big Brother is watching you. Rebecca McKinnon is a champion of digital civil rights. She's co-founder of Global Voices, an international citizen media network, and a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, where she writes about internet policy. Consent of the Networked is about the threats to internet democracy and the fight to protect it. Rebecca McKinnon, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
This book, Consent of the Networked, the subtitle of it is The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. You know, I think many, if not most, internet users in the U.S., for most of them, the internet seems very free. You can go anywhere. You can get any information you want. You can post almost anything you want. What are we not seeing when we think it's so free?
Well, there's a global trend towards more and more censorship on the internet, not only in countries like China and Iran, but also in some democracies like India, for instance. The Indian government is calling for more censorship of social media sites. And even in places like the UK, you have politicians calling for more censorship of social media. And there are a lot of European countries that have national-level censorship mechanisms in place, mainly to deal with things like child porn that everybody agrees are bad, but there are questions about, you know, to what extent can these mechanisms be abused, to what extent can there be mission creep, how can you hold accountable anybody who abuses these systems. There's also an issue of surveillance. As everyone is well aware, the digital platforms and services that we use and that we've come to depend on, of course, are collecting a lot of data about us. And this data is, of course, used for commercial purposes and sometimes resold. But it's also accessed by the government, not only in countries like China, where internet companies are expected to hand over user information upon request, but you know, law enforcement and national security authorities in this country and across the democratic world, of course, make demands on internet companies, internet service providers, wireless companies for data about what people are doing that's been collected. And there's a real question about the extent to which these powers might have been expanded too far. Of course, there are legitimate security concerns. There are legitimate concerns about crime that's committed on the internet. But how do we make sure we address these problems in ways that do not infringe on our rights to privacy, our rights to protection against unreasonable search and surveillance?
I've been around since, you know, I think I got my first Commodore 64 way back in, when was it, the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I remember thinking, this is incredible that here is a kind of network that is has been given to the world for free by not only the government, but by the defense part of the government, by ARPA. And yet, this is the greatest democratic access to media that has ever happened. And the thought occurred to me then, how long is this going to last?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is an amazing thing. And one reason why it's so amazing is that the engineers who originally invented the internet, while they may have been getting some defense money, were also kind of, you know, 60s hippies in a lot of ways, and believed in, you know, free expression. They designed the network in a very decentralized way. They made protocols that they offered up to the world for free. They didn't try and patent and trademark the basic technical standards that the whole thing ran on, so that people could then innovate and add things to it and use it without having to get permission or having to pay somebody. And, you know, one of the central points of the book is that, you know, the internet, what it is today, what you can and cannot do on it today, the fact that it's globally interconnected, the extent to which you're able to be anonymous, the extent to which you can do things on it, add websites and add applications, innovate on it without central permission, this is all not due to some, you know, natural force. This is because a lot of human beings made specific decisions about the software, about the engineering protocols. Regulators made specific decisions. Lawyers and businesses made specific decisions about how their businesses were going to work. And all of this has added up to the kind of internet we have today. But that can change. And so my argument is that whether or not the internet evolves in the future in a way that remains compatible with democracy, with dissent, with unpopular speech, with whistleblowing, or whether it evolves in a way that makes such things increasingly difficult, really depends on everybody who's shaping the network, including government regulators, including companies, and including the people who use it. And my point is, we need to stop thinking of ourselves as passive users of this technology, and we need to start thinking of ourselves as citizens of the internet. And if we want the internet to continue to be a place that we can use to speak truth to power, to advocate for our own rights, we need to fight to make sure that we have sufficient privacy on these networks, that censorship is constrained because it's really spreading around the world. And you can't assume that it's just naturally going to work out okay just because it's the internet. I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, in your community, whatever city you might live in, if you want your rights to be protected and respected, you want your interests to be protected and respected in your city, if you make no effort to pay any attention to the politics of the city or to what companies and the government are doing, and if you don't push back when you see things happening you don't like, don't be surprised when things don't turn out in a way that is respectful of your rights. You know, that you have to engage if you want your rights to be protected in your physical life, and similarly in our digital lives, if we want our rights and interests to be protected and respected, we're going to have to work for that. We're going to have to push companies to enact policies and practices that are respectful of the kind of digital world we want to live in. We need to push government. We need to pay attention to what kinds of law enforcement and cybersecurity policies and laws are being passed, and are they sufficiently respectful of our privacy and our civil liberties? And I think we saw earlier this year, there was this bill that Congress nearly passed called the Stop Online Piracy Act, and the intent of that bill was narrow. It was meant to just deal with, online copyright violation, but the solutions that were being advocated involved censorship and also involved requiring internet companies and anybody running websites to really monitor what their users were uploading or transmitting to make sure that they don't transmit any copyright infringing content. But that basically results in people having to set up greater surveillance mechanisms, as in the fabric of their businesses. And a lot of civil liberties groups were very concerned about that. And American voters called their congresspeople in very large numbers to say, we may be concerned about intellectual property, but this is not the right way to fight it. I'm concerned about my ability to use the internet in a free manner, and that bill was stopped. And I think that was an example of how people are starting to recognize that we do need to pay attention to these types of issues.
We're talking with Rebecca McKinnon about her book, Consent of the Networked: The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. You mentioned the word citizens, and in your book, Consent of the Networked, you talk in the book about the digital commons. Here, what you've just talked about is being a net citizen, a citizen of the digital commons, and also copyright, which is all about, in some way, the corporate enclosure of that digital commons. What is the domain that is open to citizenship, and what is the domain that is rendered under the corporate Caesar?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a problem. It's becoming more and more murky. Increasingly we are dependent on digital devices, services, and platforms that are owned and operated by the private sector, not only, for our social lives and our businesses and our jobs and our schooling and so on, but also for our political activity. The public square has moved into these privately run spaces. And so there's one question of, to what extent should we try and take the, create more spaces online that are not run by companies, that are more non-commercial, and create a larger commons so that there's more room for the political discourse to happen without having to be concerned about your data being excessively collected for commercial purposes and other issues like that. But at the same time, you're seeing, let's take Facebook, for example. You look at, say, for instance, political campaigns. The Obama campaign re-election strategy is heavily dependent on Facebook. A lot of organizations, activist organizations, trying to reach broad swaths of the public are all using Facebook because that's where everybody is. That's where everybody has gone. And so one really important question is, given that the public square and given that our politics have moved into these private domains, if we want democracy to survive in a form that's recognizable as democracy and in a form where controversial speech, unpopular people have the ability to speak out without feeling excessively endangered, do these private companies actually have an obligation to serve the public interest to some degree? I'm not saying that we should nationalize these companies or require that every feature on Facebook be put to a vote of all the users, but do we need to have some mechanisms by which we get these companies to commit to core principles on free expression, on privacy, on civil liberties, and that their platforms and services need to be run in a way that is compatible with essentially human rights, and compatible with a free public discourse, because otherwise they're going to render, you know, the entire sort of political environment unsustainable, or they're going to take it in a direction we don't want it to go. And so just as we expect companies, you know, yes, okay, their primary, you know, the primary business of business is to turn profits and so on, but we also expect that companies have an obligation not to render our air unbreathable or our water undrinkable. We expect companies not to hire 12-year-olds, even though that might make them more profitable, and to respect the rights of their workers, and to not destroy both the environment and the general living conditions of the communities that they operate in. The idea that they need to behave in a sustainable manner is something we expect of companies. And while companies are far from perfect, I think for the most part, certainly American industry does not deny that they have these responsibilities. And I think similarly, we really need to push for companies to recognize that with their power comes responsibility, that they are having an impact ultimately on our political environment, and they need to behave in a way that's sustainable.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rebecca MacKinnon about her book, Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. Isn't one issue, however, that the laws that we have to protect public speech, to protect us from surveillance, weakened though they are becoming, even in the public sphere, operate only in the public sphere, that basically you don't have civil rights. I mean, you may have certain, you know, regulated rights in the workplace that have been won through collective bargaining, but you don't really have civil rights in the workplace. The First Amendment, for example, doesn't operate. Could you talk about, say, for example, with the case of WikiLeaks and Amazon, how the government was able to do an end run around civil rights by putting pressure on private corporations to do its bidding?
Yeah, so exactly. This is one of the problems where if you sign up for whether it's your internet service provider or, you know, a Facebook account or a Gmail account, or, you know, if you want to run a website and you need a web hosting service like Amazon Web Hosting, for instance, when you sign up for an account, you're of course agreeing to the terms of service. You have to click agree at some point if you want to set up your account, and generally you're waiving your rights in those cases, and generally there will be a list of conditions under which the company can terminate your account. And in the case of Amazon Web Hosting, basically it says the company can terminate your account for pretty much any reason. And so what happened was that WikiLeaks, right around the time that they published the first batch of diplomatic cables, they had their website running out of Sweden, but they had come under heavy hacking attacks, basically. So had decided to move their account to Amazon Web Services because Amazon Web Services has very good security. And so they were running, when they published the cables, they were running their website off of Amazon Web Services. And of course, the publication of the cables upset a lot of people here in the United States, in the U.S. government. And you had a number of American politicians calling for the arrest of Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, and people declaring that what it had done was illegal. And, you know, we put aside the case of the person, Bradley Manning, in the U.S. military who had actually obtained the cables. But the issue around WikiLeaks itself and its right to publish the cables, you know, nobody has brought a legal case against WikiLeaks. Nobody has taken them to court. There has certainly been no conviction or judgment. There is a very strong argument that WikiLeaks has a First Amendment right to be publishing what it published. So despite this, despite that absolutely no legal process had happened, Amazon ended up dropping WikiLeaks as a customer because prominent politicians like Senator Joe Lieberman said they should, because essentially it was unpatriotic to be hosting them. The U.S. State Department issued an opinion that WikiLeaks was conducting illegal activity, although, again, nothing was ever even taken to court. No case was even brought. But just based on these opinions of certain members of the U.S. government, Amazon Web Hosting decided that it wasn't worth continuing to do business with WikiLeaks and dropped them as a customer. And what this shows is that when unpopular speech or when political speech of various kinds, controversial speech, is dependent on these commercial services to reach wide audiences, and when these commercial services are under no obligation to uphold First Amendment rights, as you know, Amazon and all these commercial services do not have to do, there is this question of, is that ultimately going to chill our political discourse? Is that going to make it just a little bit harder for unpopular speech to gain a wide audience? And there are a number of other examples that are not as prominent or quite as controversial as WikiLeaks, but show companies making decisions about what they thought was kind of too controversial and not letting it on their services. And one example that I cite in the book is Apple with their App Store. They use their own criteria to decide what is appropriate and what is not appropriate to allow in their App Store. And there was a political cartoonist named Mark Fiore who ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize, whose app was declined. They wouldn't publish his app because he had cartoons making fun of the president, and somebody at Apple decided it was his cartoons were too offensive to be allowed in the App Store, even though the type of speech that Fiore was engaging in is very much kind of standard First Amendment protected political satire. And you see this a lot, that his app was not actually approved until after he got his Pulitzer Prize. There are a lot of other satirists who found that their apps just don't get approved in the App Store because they're considered too controversial or sensitive for various reasons. But, you know, it's up to Apple to decide they can run or not run whatever apps they want. And as increasingly more and more people are using iPhones and iPads as their primary way to get news and get information and get content, and you have a private company like Apple exercising its own criteria of what speech is appropriate and acceptable and what speech is not, and their criteria are much more narrow than the First Amendment and fairly arbitrary, that's a real concern.
And also not to mention the fact that, you know, many of these companies want things from the federal government. They want legislation passed in their favor. So it's kind of scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, certainly a lot of lobbying that's going on all sides.
So is it possible? I mean, these huge commercial companies have built these networks. How is it possible, or is it possible, to push back, not just, let's say, by writing your congressperson, but also even technologically? What are some of the ways that the net citizens can increase their own balance in the balance of power?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different things we can do. I mean, one is we can just become more vocal, and we can, you know, when you're using Facebook, if you're using Google services and you're concerned about what's going on, there are ways to get your voices heard and communicate with the company and let them know that you're not happy and that you may cease to be a user if they do not respect your concerns. I think users do need to get more organized. We need to find more systematic ways of really engaging in collective bargaining between users and the companies. So rather than just kind of creating a Facebook page to say, oh, we don't like this policy, I think we need to, you know, get people more organized and go in and have meetings with the executives and say, look, you know, here are some issues that are really of concern to the network's most vulnerable members, and you need to change this. There's also something called the Global Network Initiative, which is an organization I'm involved with. It's trying to get companies to basically commit to standards on free expression and privacy and to uphold them, not many companies have joined, and I think part of the reason is that there hasn't been a lot of public pressure to join. I think there could be a lot more pressure to join from consumers and also from investors. You know, we've seen a lot of investment funds emerge and a growing percentage of pension funds and 401ks invested in socially responsible funds that pick and choose stocks not only on their financial performance, but on whether these companies fit basic criteria on environmental standards and labor standards and other human rights standards. And investors are starting now to look at free expression and privacy and the extent to which companies are respectful of these values in their investment decisions. I think we need a much broader global movement. I mean, we've seen the dial get moved on environmental practices, on labor practices, on other human rights practices, but it's taken a big global movement, you know, people joining organizations and signing petitions and going to marches and really making their concerns known. And I think you're going to have to see that happen with the internet as well. Also, you know, there are tools we can use to protect our privacy and to get around censorship. There's something called Tor. You can download the software at torproject.org. It's an anonymizing tool that works with Firefox. And basically, what it does is it not only helps you get around censorship, but it anonymizes your traffic so that when you visit a website, the person who runs the organization running the website doesn't know where you're coming from, can't trace back to who you are. And so that protects you both against commercial tracking as well as government surveillance.
And Drew Adamek just has let me know, our associate producer has a question for you.
As companies like Amazon and Facebook and Twitter become more ubiquitous, their communication technologies become locked in, and the way that we communicate and what we can communicate is determined by the tools that we use. The medium becomes the message. Is there a danger of to democracy and free speech in the way that these forms or these physical structures limit our speech?
Well, I think that's definitely true, and as more and more people are accessing the internet through smartphones as opposed to their PCs, that becomes even more the case, where, you know, unlike on your laptop or your home computer, where you can write software programs and kind of install pretty much whatever you want, change the operating system, you know, with something like an iPhone or an iPad, you're kind of stuck with the programs and the systems that Apple wants you to use. You can't change the phone's operating system without rendering it unusable with Apple. And they're determining what apps you can use and what content is on those apps. So that's a real issue. And it's also an issue, too, where you have, as we're moving to more mobile internet, the internet gets less neutral. And on the kind of broadband internet, the internet you use from your computer, there are regulations in place and kind of standards and practices, you know, standard commercial practices that, you know, if you're trying to access YouTube or you're trying to access Rebecca McKinnon's home video streaming service, the access is going to be the same. The company is not going to restrict your access to one platform over the other or make it easier to access one platform or over the other. They're expected to be neutral. But on the mobile internet, you're frequently seeing situations where, for instance, a mobile company will do a deal with YouTube where, you know, if you want to upload videos from your phone, you have to do it through YouTube, and if people want to watch online videos, it's much cheaper to do so, or their data rate is different if they watch the videos from one service than from another. And yeah, that locks people in. And you're seeing in the developing world, actually, there's something called Facebook Zero, where Facebook does a deal with the local mobile companies whereby if you're accessing Facebook on your phone, it doesn't cost you anything other than whatever your monthly data rate is. But if you're accessing, you know, Human Rights Watch or Rebecca McKinnon's blog, you're paying a per megabyte fee. So that kind of drives people to these big commercial platforms and away from kind of more grassroots nonprofit and kind of citizen created or homemade websites. And that, when it comes to free expression, is quite troubling, especially when Facebook has terms of service that require people to use their real name. Otherwise, you can get kicked off the service. And if you're an activist and you're using a fake name on the platform, it's very likely your enemies will report you for violating the terms of service and you'll get your account deactivated. And there are also a lot of concerns, of course, with Facebook's privacy policies and exposure of people's personal data. So it's very troubling on a lot of levels, which is why we really need to push for more open standards, greater interoperability between different platforms, and why having a robust digital commons that I talk about in the book and non-commercial alternatives and an internet that enables users to access the non-commercial alternatives at the same cost as the commercial services is very, very important.
And, of course, we know that in much of the developing world, it is those mobile networks which are far more used than the at-home network. Rebecca MacKinnon, your book is Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. We've just skimmed the surface of this fascinating and very important book. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much.
Rebecca MacKinnon is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where she writes about the impact of digital technologies on human rights. Go to writersvoice.net to hear her TED Talk and read an excerpt from Consent of the Networked. Next up, we delve into the WikiLeaks controversy and what it bodes for press freedom and the freedom of the Internet. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Remember WikiLeaks?
Well, what I really learned in the last 3 years is that a difference can be made bottom-up and not only top-down.
Information does not respect borders. States are going to have to rethink how they approach information. Any state which fails to do this will cease to exist.
Well, you know, if we're going to have a military and a defense policy, it's predicated on having information that is controlled. Of course, we're a democracy. We're one of the most open countries, I believe, in the history of the world. But information has to be protected in certain circumstances and denied to the public.
Democracy without transparency is no democracy. I mean, that's just an empty word.
That's a clip from the Swedish TV documentary WikiLeaks Rebels. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and Bradley Manning is still under threat of spending the rest of his life in jail. As reported in Huffington Post last week, a coalition of activists and journalists, including Assange, filed lawsuit against the Department of Defense and the military judge overseeing the case of Army Private Bradley Manning. The suit aims to open up access to the military trial in which Manning is fighting to avoid a life sentence after admitting to leaking hundreds of thousands of sensitive documents to WikiLeaks. In 2010, we talked with the late great journalist Alexander Coburn about the significance of WikiLeaks for press freedom, and with Tim Carr, spokesperson for the organization Free Press. First, I asked Carr, what does government's attempt to silence WikiLeaks say about emerging threats to a citizen's right to know?
It's an amazing phenomenon, but it doesn't feel as though it is something that has come out of the blue. I think anybody who has been watching the way governments treat privileged information historically know that they were heading on a collision path with the internet. And WikiLeaks is just a glaring, glaring example of that, where you now have an individual who has access to privileged information, an organization that has access to privileged information. In the most recent case, State Department cables on international affairs coming out of embassies all around the world, who makes this information public and has now felt the full force, well, probably not the full force yet, but a very powerful reaction from one of the most powerful governments in the world. And I think what is particularly interesting and even worrying from the perspective of Free Press, that does a lot of work on this, is the amount of collusion that we have seen coming from corporations, collusion between government and very powerful corporations. WikiLeaks' website was yanked from its server. The PayPal service that they were using to raise money was closed down. And these were all actions taken by corporations, taken by companies that control web hosting services and payment services, basically at the behest of the U.S. government. And so you see this kind of collusion happening now, and again, there is a history of this. If you go back to 2007 and 2008, you'll find that you remember the whole controversy surrounding FISA, wiretapping of telephone conversations by phone companies without legal warrant. There was a very large controversy late in the Bush administration where companies like AT&T and Verizon were allegedly tapping phone conversations without getting legal warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So what's happening with WikiLeaks is very much a part of that trend, and it's something that I think we need to be very vigilant about, because governments are over-exercising their power to stifle what is essentially free speech.
Tim Carr, you're saying, in effect, that on the one hand, governments are attacking the privacy of individuals and recruiting companies to help it do that. And on the other hand, government is shutting down attempts by individuals or non-government organizations to make government more transparent and recruiting corporations to do that.
Yeah, and I don't know how overt this is. Pressure has been applied, whether these powerful corporations are doing this in and of their own volition, or whether they're getting direct communications from the government to close down WikiLeaks' website, to close down its payment service. Where, you know, at some point WikiLeaks might leak information about how this all unfolded. But I think what you have, anybody who spent a lot of time in Washington D.C. or close to government, you realize that there's a sort of cult of secrecy that pervades Washington, and there's a lot of power that comes with having information. In many ways, a lot of power comes from withholding information from others, and the State Department and others have been criticized for being overly secretive. And what you're seeing with WikiLeaks is I think in many ways a backlash to that cult of secrecy, where they're saying, you know, some of this stuff that is being done in the name of U.S. taxpayers, but oftentimes without their consent or even knowledge, is things that should be made more transparent. And so it's interesting how it has divided so many people in the United States. And for some, this is not a question of free speech, but more a question of national security. And the debate that has raged over the last several weeks has been pretty instructive, very interesting. And interesting to see how certain players fall out as to their position on this.
Is a security issue being used to defend not national security, but the power of states to protect secrets?
Yes, in many ways it is. I mean, again, information is a very powerful thing, and as is withholding information from others. And I think, you know, a lot of the accusations that have been thrown at WikiLeaks over the last weeks have actually turned out to be untrue. There's a there's a sense that that WikiLeaks has been recklessly making information public in ways that endangered the lives of certain individuals who are working as informants for the U.S. government overseas and things like that. And as, you know, as it's turned out, and at least from my understanding of the way publications like the New York Times and the Guardian and others have used this information, it has been a fairly thorough vetting process in collaboration with WikiLeaks to make sure that those sorts of harms to individuals and others are handled carefully, that certain information that could bring harm to individuals has been redacted from a lot of these files, and that the information that we're getting, for the most part, is really about the sort of secrets that the government has been keeping from us, secrets like military operations in Yemen that the U.S. government said it wasn't involved with, for example, that I think is important. These are important issues, the way that certain suspects, Al-Qaeda suspects, have been sent overseas to other nations where they are subsequently tortured and in some cases killed. You know, this is important information. This is a fundamental human rights issue. There's issues of international policy and violations of law that I think American citizens have the right to know about. So while a lot of the material has been characterized as being somewhat, you know, immaterial or you know, simply gossip, I think there are other points to WikiLeaks and information in these cables that is truly important. So, well, it's been very controversial the way these have been handled and the ways these have come out, but at the end of the day, I think it's a good thing that people know what's being done in our name. And so it's been interesting. And obviously, we have yet to, you know, they still say that we've only seen the tip of the iceberg, but there's much more information that is going to be made public. There's information not only about government secrets, but WikiLeaks has indicated that there's going to be an upcoming release of information related to the Bank of America and other financial institutions and the ways that they were handling mortgage defaults and all of that, which is also critical information from about the private sector that has direct bearing on our economy. So this is a story that's not going to end soon, and I think the conversation that's happening around it right now is actually healthy for our democracy and healthy for Americans.
The WikiLeaks release of the embassy cables gave rise to a pushback from the U.S. government, getting MasterCard, PayPal, and the others to disconnect supporters from those sites. And that pushback has now led to a payback from supporters of WikiLeaks against those companies. With these battle lines being drawn up on the Internet, does this bode well or ill for the future of openness on the web?
Well, we're seeing a kind of cyber warfare, but it's not warfare in the traditional sense. Here we have concerned citizens or concerned WikiLeaks supporters who have the technical means to do things, hitting back against some of these corporations that have attempted to close down WikiLeaks. And so you're seeing online right now a kind of battle between citizen activists and corporate powers. And so, I mean, I think you'll have social scientists, political science, political historians, you know, looking at what's going on right now for decades, and it may be just the beginning of something where we have these sort of loose-knit multinational groups, groups like 4chan, which is a somewhat nefarious collaboration of online individuals who have the capacity via their high-speed internet connection and via the social networks that they've built online to actually attack institutions in ways that may not cause physical harm, but certainly cause financial harm and send a very powerful message about, you know, who really controls the internet and who really has power over information.
Tim Carr of Free Press, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
First you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future. future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who've sacrificed the public good for your private gain.
Alexander Coburn has been a journalist since the early 1970s. He edits the political newsletter Counterpunch and writes the Nation column Beat the Devil. His recent article on WikiLeaks in that column spurred me to call him up to get more of his take on the WikiLeaks phenomenon.
Well, I think what WikiLeaks has been doing, not just in the three very famous sets of disclosures of the last few months, but over, you know, recent times, is good. But we live in a society, you know, obsessed with secrecy. The state is steadily trying to make more and more things secret which shouldn't be secret at all. And WikiLeaks has, of course, been challenging that. And the cables that it got on Iraq and Afghanistan, including, of course, the famous film of the Apache helicopter murdering journalists and ordinary people in Baghdad, has been very important because it's completely contradicted the pretensions of the U.S. military and of the U.S. State Department and of the U.S. government. And that's to be applauded. That's the job of journalism. And so they're doing a job of journalism which many so-called journalists in the mainstream press, in CNN, in ABC, and NBC, and so forth, haven't been doing at all. And, of course, the very latest one, which has caused this most enormous fuss, is, again, admirable, because most of the cables are not of extreme secrecy. And in fact, 2.5 million people had authorization to read those cables. They can't be actually deadly secrets, really. 2.5 million people is a lot of people. So that's all to the good. What it has shown is something that, again, people have been aware of for quite some time, which is how extremely vulnerable our mainstream means of communication these days, in other words, the Internet, is open to government censorship and interdiction. In the column I just did for The Nation, I drew attention to the fact that in 1967, when Ramparts magazine, which actually finally morphed into Mother Jones magazine, which you probably know it as, they published details of the secret way in which the CIA had been using the National Students Association as a front organization. There was an enormous fuss. The CIA authorized dirty tricks operations against Ramparts. The FBI conducted what's called a full court investigation. At no time did the government actually try and march people into the offices and close it down, because they knew, of course, there'd be a First Amendment challenge. Particularly with print materials, you go in and try and close a press down, there are, you know, the first constitutional rights to free speech. That was then, about 2 years later, in 1973 or so, a CIA case officer called Philip Agee actually left the agency and then went to England and arranged to write a Penguin book called Inside the Company, which was the first really major detailed disclosure of what a CIA officer does. Both of these enterprises had more secrets in them than what WikiLeaks has divulged. But in both cases, I mean, if it had been today, of course, seeing what's happened to Assange and WikiLeaks, the CIA would have been closing down all electronic business of Ramparts. It would have been threatening Penguin Books, which did publish Agee's book in 1975. They would have, Amazon would have immediately not featured it on Amazon, which would have been a death blow for the book. And it just highlights the difference between what's happened now. And in WikiLeaks, you know, they've now, what have they done? This collusion of government and commercial enterprise, they've closed WikiLeaks, although, of course, there are, what, over 1,000 mirror sites now. They've managed to get Visa and MasterCharge to cancel their credit card business. They've persuaded Amazon, of course, not to be a host to them. They've persuaded the Swiss bank no longer to honor their accounts. And they're gone. Now, there was no courtroom hearing. There was no challenge. There's no way WikiLeaks can go back into court with any possibility of mounting an illegal challenge. So this is what we face.
Is this a new development? Is freedom of the content on the Internet now subject to the whims of private companies that are hosting that content?
Totally. Totally. State and private, both. or a mix of the two. State operating on behalf of the private people carrying out what the state wants them to do. And the moment we've got, you know, the internet, which should be a public electronic commons, you know, it is being steadily privatized. And people don't really realize the dangers. A lot of people, let's say they're on Facebook. Soon Facebook will be running its email. Everything they do on Facebook will be through Facebook portals. So supposing suddenly they want to access material Facebook doesn't care for, or government has told Facebook it doesn't support, those people will be trapped inside Facebook without being able to find out what's going on. So it's a great plus that WikiLeaks was able to take advantage of, you know, lax security and their knowledge of how the net works. That's good to expose this huge, huge, insane government secrecy, which is supported and connived at by many journalists and institutions, by the way. And on the other hand, the ease with which the government can strike back. That's a very big crisis for anybody interested in democratic communication.
What are you seeing is the response of journalists to WikiLeaks?
Well, it's mixed. I mean, some journalists are doing their duty and seeing this as a great opportunity, and other journalists are very nervous and cautious, like the New York Times. You know, in the second WikiLeaks dump, the big one about the Afghanistan, I think it was, a few months ago, you know, they on the one hand, they used some of the WikiLeaks material, actually from The Guardian. On the other hand, they wrote very nasty attacks on Assange. So they were like having their cake and eating it too. And in this one now, they keep asserting how everything has been scrutinized, made sure that nobody's, you know, going to be compromised, no real security. And WikiLeaks actually has cooperated with this, you know. Already a lot of probably excessive filtering going on. So it again, and then you get really, you know, traitors to the profession, such as the guy on CNN, you know.
Is that Wolf Blitzer?
Yeah, Wolf Blitzer, you know, screaming for more secrecy.
Do you think that the government is going to go after the press organs, like the New York Times and the others that have revealed the WikiLeaks content? Do you think this is going to open things up or close things down?
Well, if the government feels it can push and not get a pushback, it'll get more and more demanding. It's already told people that no one who hopes to work for the government or the State Department should even look at the WikiLeaks online. Senator Lieberman has said the Times itself may have broken the laws, and that anybody who's actually saved a WikiLeaks document is by definition, committing a breach of the espionage laws or whatever it is. So they'll go on doing this until some voice of sanity intervenes. Of course, Congress, as always in these national security scares, most of them, you know, are only too eager to sit down and write new emergency laws, just like they did with the Patriot Act and so forth. When these people panic, you know, the results are always bad.
I asked Coburn, what can people do to protect internet democracy?
Well, there's a number of avenues that can be creative technologically. They seem very knowledgeable, but there's got to be a push. I mean, it sounds very unpromising in the current context to strengthen constitutional freedoms and, you know, the right to have a hearing and to contest a government challenge to remove your website. What we can't have now is effectively you're taken away in the middle of the night and shot. Your site is just gone. It's like, you know, you're hauled off to the gulag. That's it. Goodbye. And that's a very, very dangerous and very menacing.
Journalist Alexander Coburn. I spoke with him in 2010. He died in 2012. You can find links to his writings on Julian Assange at writersvoice.net.
There was a man who wrote the truth about governments and war. But the truth exposed the liars for the criminals they were. We should hunt him down and murder him, some like Sarah Palin swore. Then the credit cards and PayPal and the web hosts joined the fight. But they only cared for money, not free speech or people's rights. So they chose to please the powerful instead of freedom, truth, or right.
And now we just have time for a poem by New York-based poet Philip Schultz.
Bleecker Street. It's a lovely June afternoon, and I'm heading up Bleecker Street for a hazelnut espresso latte, the kind made out of real hazelnuts, not syrup, hoping it will empty me of all my bickering ideas about love and fate and immortality, so I can hear the fertile songs of spring. Miguel de Unamuno, whose name is impossible to say without smiling, believed self-love widens into love of all that lives. Thank God for Unamuno, for hazelnut lattes. But the infinite archaeology of my stupidity prefers the charms of self-pity to the equilibrium of self-love. Perhaps these three Chinese girls giggling into cell phones, lavishly spending each moment of their youth, truly believe the mountain of self has no top, and each breath is a reckoning with fate. Perhaps the shiny boutiques, each so resolute, so eager to please, are weary of decorating the illusions of another century, prefer the runaway slaves they hid in their root cellars, their dreams of slaughter and deliverance. Perhaps this beautiful blonde woman, screeching to a stop in a lilac Mercedes, pursued by wailing police cars, finally understands that it is not only for the soul, but for the mind, that happiness is a necessity. Is the rich bimbo stoned or just stupid? An old man, radiant with rage, screams. Perhaps everyone secretly admires something momentous about himself, with the mass and inner life of a cathedral, in the tradition of the Spanish saints and mystics who cherished the bliss of infinite sacrifice. Perhaps the street remembers the loneliness of war widows, the roll calls of absent names, its first kisses on the corner of West 10th Street, the swooning confetti heat of victory, the scalding springs of defeat. Indeed, the street is a wave of advocacy and streaming window peonies and tulips, a fierce glimpse of history, an echoing of nightly gunshots, a flag of black pigeons flowing east toward the end of a continent, a hunger for immortality, a tiny brusque city, a bickering idea, a useless boutique, a fertile song widening into a love for all that lives.
That was Philip Schultz reading his poem, Bleecker Street, from his collection, The God of Loneliness. It was recorded at Canio Books in Sag Harbor, New York, in April 2010. You can get a link to listen to the entire reading by the poet by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.